In 1841, we're going back a little ways, the Unitarian minister Theodore Parker preached a sermon at a colleague's ordination service called The Transient and the Permanent in Christianity. See, in those days, American Unitarianism was still a Christian tradition, a liberal one that had already departed from the view that Jesus was an incarnation of God. The people who held this view, the Jesus as an incarnation of God, were Trinitarians, right? They believed in the Trinity as God in three figures, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The Trinitarian view, incidentally, just in case you don't know this, was not found in the Bible, but rather had been decided by a council called by the Roman Emperor Constantine as the early church was forming by his decree back in the year 325. So Parker himself was a Christian. And Parker had even been a biblical literalist before widening his theology to include the possibility that the Bible could maybe be a book of wisdom written by human hands. Unitarians of the day widely believed that some religious truths could be known through human reason, but that there were truths that could only be known through divine revelation. And the Bible was the source of that miraculous revelation. Little context. But by 1841, Parker's theology had evolved to the point that he no longer believed that there was one truth contained in the doctrines of Christianity, and this particular sermon emphasized that Jesus preached what he called the absolute religion. This religion that Jesus preached, his message that we are to love God and our neighbors, this religion, Parker said, was permanent. This was the permanent, the religious truth that remains always. The transient, the thing that can change, was the doctrines that the church had built around these teachings, like the understanding of God as a Trinity. Parker also questioned whether the accounts of miracles in the Bible were factual. This was groundbreaking in his day. And whether the Bible and Jesus were miraculous revelations. The Trinitarians heard about this sermon, and they exploded. And they demanded that the Unitarians tell them whether they considered Parker a Christian. And the Unitarians, well, they threw Parker under the bus. They decided that his theology wasn't Christian, and they didn't want to hear the possibilities that he was coming to understand as his theology evolved. They stopped exchanging pulpits with him, which meant that they refused to let their congregations hear what he had to preach, and they cut him out of fellowship with them, leaving him isolated from his fellow ministers. Parker was also ahead of his time in his social and his political analyses, and he believed that the structures of power in the U.S. needed reform. He believed that government would be at its best when it was an organic expression of the whole people's mind, conscience, and piety, that was controlled by no individual or class, and that acted on behalf of all, not on behalf of an individual or class. And the American social order, he believed, should value people for their work and their character rather than their wealth and social position. He said that government would only be a true democracy when it was, quote, of all the people, by all the people, and for all the people. I find it interesting that this pariah of American Christianity also happened to be a guy who could step outside the system of oppression to see it for what it was as it was still being built. Like almost all the white men of his day, he believed that African Americans were inferior to European Americans. This was common belief, just like Jesus being the Son of God. And he still opposed slavery vehemently and publicly. He spoke out against the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, the legislation that required white people to report runaway slaves in the North, calling it a violation of Christian ideals and a threat to free institutions. But even then, it seemed that working within the system to change it proved to be impossible. And so Parker was one of the Secret Six who supported John Brown in his attempt to steal weapons in the 1859 raid on Harper's Ferry, Virginia, to arm a slave rebellion. So Parker didn't just evolve theologically. He heard a call to work for justice out of that evolution of his. The religious historian Dean Grodzins points out in a book he wrote on Parker that his commitment to social justice and political reform was rooted in that liberal Christian faith of his. Grodzins traces what some have called Parker's evolution from minister-scholar to minister-activist, and shows how for Parker, social action was rooted theologically in the love of God and expressed in daring support for human freedom. I believe that that is a tradition that Unitarian Universalism now has tried and tries to continue to follow, to explore what we believe about the nature of the divine and to figure out what it means to how we see that which in our lives are rooted and to move forward into life based on what we learn. This plays out in a lot of ways. In 1965, when Martin Luther King Jr. called on religious people and religious leaders to stand with him and other black people in Selma, people who were facing brutal violence for fighting for the right to vote, hundreds of Unitarian Universalists went. James Reeb, a white UU minister from Boston, had a theological story not unlike that of Theodore Parker. He began as a devout and conservative Christian and converted to Unitarianism as his theological grounding became more and more humanistic. When he applied for Unitarian ministerial fellowship, he wrote these words, "I want to participate in the continuous creation of a vision that will inspire our people to noble and courageous living. I want to share actively in the adventure of trying to forge the spiritual ties that will bind mankind together in brotherhood and peace." This desire to live out his faith in humanity moved him to work against inequalities in poor and largely black neighborhoods in his city, and eventually to come to understand that those inequalities were caused by systemic racism. And so, when Reverend Reeb heard the call to Selma, he couldn't not respond. And he died there, a martyr to the civil rights movement. Meanwhile, hundreds of other UUs marched in Selma, and then they went home. They went home to their families and their churches, transformed by that experience. All the sermons they had heard or preached about justice, all the talking they had done before going, they could feel those things now, those things that move through you when you are called to action out of your faith. They could feel how it was empowering and fulfilling to do something of consequence in the world based on their faith. And so then, within our faith community, there were people who had had that amazing experience and people who had not. And it became really hard for some folks to have conversations about the root issue of racism across that lack of shared experience. Over the next several years, two UU-affiliated groups formed, and this is a very simplistic version of this history, formed to try to form a response to the revolution happening around us in the mid to late 60s and to empower the black people in our movement, which we had failed in many ways throughout previous history. So there was the Black Affairs Council. They were a black-only group that sought to develop black-controlled projects to aid black people. And there was the Black and White Alternative, who believed that the existence of a black-only group was racist and not inclusive. The delegates of our 1968 General Assembly voted to commit $1 million out of our national budget to the Black Affairs Council, the black-only group, to support its programming. And then, almost immediately after the vote, The UUA's Board of Trustees learned that it had way less money than it thought it did to support its programs. In spite of this, when the board met in 1969, it voted not to reduce the money that the delegates had committed to the Black Affairs Council. They tried. And then it voted to also grant $50,000 to the Black and White Alternative. This had to be affirmed at the 1969 General Assembly by the delegates, because that's what we do. We are an association of member congregations, and our process calls us to come together and vote on our issues as members. The vote was hugely controversial. The debate for it, for one, was scheduled at the end of General Assembly, and it was proposed during the plenary sessions that something this important should be discussed a little earlier in the agenda. There were several votes to try to change the agenda, and after heated debate and a failure to do so, to change it, many Blacks and more than 400 whites walked out of General Assembly in frustration. They were persuaded to come back the next day, and a narrow majority voted to fund only the Black Affairs Council. I've talked with people who were there. I've read interviews with people I haven't talked with, and the hurt they carry from feeling betrayed by their UU siblings, whichever side of this they were on, is huge. Still, people on all sides of this, who were living their faith by taking action to be part of what was supposed to be a movement toward Black empowerment and liberation, they were convinced they were going about it the right way, and they couldn't see the value in the other approach. Imagine yourself there, believing passionately and completely that what you were doing was right, and that there are people who claimed the same faith tradition and principles as you, doing everything they could to disempower what you were doing and you knew was right. It threatened to split our denomination in two. It did not. The following January, the UUA board decided to change the structure of the promised support, this $1 million, to the Black Affairs Council because of the budgetary constraints, from $250,000 a year for 4 years to $200,000 a year for 5 years. And then they voted in a flurry of budget cuts because, remember, this was happening in the context of the shrinking budget, to reduce the first year's support payment by $50,000. The Black Affairs Council met and voted to disaffiliate from the UUA so that they could raise their own funds, which they were not allowed to do under our process if they were affiliated. Later, in analyses of this whole thing, and this is hours and hours of conversation, right, to have about this, but later, in analyses of this whole thing, which is referred to in our denomination as the empowerment controversy, people have said things like, we were the first denomination to act in behalf of Black empowerment, and we were the first to turn our backs on Black empowerment. And the majority of white Unitarian Universalists did not accept the responsibility to understand, nurture, and own the program that they had dared to embrace in Cleveland in 1968. The 2015 General Assembly vote on the action of immediate witness to support the Black Lives Matter movement was nowhere near as contentious. But the process was still painful for some, and the conversation was difficult. The process to make a statement like this, just like individual decisions to take action, is based on both principles and rules. An action of immediate witness, or AIW, quote, expresses the conscience and carries the authority of the delegates at the GA in which it was passed. It is not a statement because the AIWs haven't been brought to all congregations for reflection and debate, like statements of conscience are. They're not considered official statements of the UUA. They're appeals to congregations to move forward into some work. So they're the start of a congregation, and they let you use respond quickly to social actions, to social issues that we think are urgent. So at our last GA, our youth caucus brought forward this proposed AIW. Our youth caucus is a group of Unitarian Universalist youth that speak together in a voice as congregations get to speak together in a voice during plenary sessions. And they fully followed the process to do so. They submitted what they needed to submit, and then they held what's called a mini-assembly to draft the actual language of the action of immediate witness and to give delegates the chance who were not part of the youth caucus, but other delegates, the chance to submit amendments to it. So this is an open process of trying to craft this thing and amend it. You might be able to imagine how emotional and difficult just this mini assembly was, as you consider how strongly people feel about the Black Lives Matter movement, and how strongly some Unitarian Universalists feel about making sure our language is just right. And it's funny, but it's not. After that happens, the UUA Commission on Social Witness meets to decide which amendments to incorporate and prioritizes the unincorporated amendments for possible adoption by the whole set of delegates in the big plenary session. And then the amended AIW is available for delegates to review. And then on Sunday, the very last day of GA, the delegates debate and they vote on each proposed AIW. The debate in general plenary on this AIW took an hour and 40 minutes. That's unusually long. An hour and 10 minutes of this debate was over the use of the words prison abolition, a term that the Black Lives Matter movement uses to describe the replacement of the current prison system with one that is not based on racial discrimination. It's grounded in the history of abolition during slave times, which demanded the right to self-determination and built the foundation for contemporary Black liberation movements. That's from the Black Lives Matter website. The Youth Caucus chose this term deliberately in solidarity with the Black Lives movement, and it was cheered by the folks in the room who understand the huge step that we were trying to take to show that we'll follow the people leading this movement, right? It took a long and emotional hour and 10 minutes for the delegates at large to decide to craft a modifier to the original language and to be satisfied with it, while the youth and the people of color and many of their allies in the room became more and more frustrated with the need to create that modifier. Barb read this. Be it further resolved that the 2015 General Assembly encourages member congregations and all Unitarian Universalists to work toward police reform and prison abolition. And here's the modifier, which seeks to replace the current prison system with a system that is more just and equitable. This wasn't a cause for a breach in our denomination, and I think ultimately it was another in a long set of steps that we need to take in the wake of the empowerment controversy and the lingering issues behind it. We need to have these difficult conversations, and we need to learn to have them in a way that doesn't harm the people of color in our congregations and our communities. One more story. The Beverly Unitarian Church, or BUC, is on the south side of Chicago, where there's a large proportion of police officers and firefighters living in their community. The church has a wayside pulpit, do you know what that is? A sign that you can change the saying on, with a rotating message, and they change it every 2 weeks. The Board of Trustees there recently voted to have the words Black Lives Matter be one of the rotating messages there. As soon as the message went up, their community pushed back, because the members of the surrounding community have heard the rhetoric that the Black Lives Matter movement is a hate group and a terrorist organization that threatens police and white people. They were watching Fox News. Oh, sorry. They heard this rhetoric, and being the people that they are, being police officers and families of police officers and firefighters, They bought into the fear. And so people called the church to complain. Someone actually accosted a member outside this church to say, "You want my uncle to be killed because he's a cop." There were threats to the lives of members and their families. And so they pulled the sign ahead of when it was supposed to be rotated out. And they replaced it with these words, "Unite against hate and fear, stand with us against racism." I don't have time to get into the Black Lives Matter and the All Lives Matter debate, and we're going to talk about that at some point, I hope. But when that happened, Black UUs felt betrayed. Black Lives Matter is what they're asking us to get behind. And white allies were outraged, assuming that BUC was backing off because of the similar situations we've heard about vandalism of signs. And they, white UUs, threw the BUC folks under the bus. The people of BUC and their minister now realize that there was so much work they needed to do before putting up that sign, to be aware of the community that they're in, to be ready for the possibility of negative responses, to ask for the support of other congregations and allies. And they have learned, and they are diving into that work now. And the people attacking them for backing off, the white UUs, they've learned a little bit about getting some context about the situation before jumping into judgment. And the African American folks are sitting with that betrayal still. The ones I've talked to, anyway. We adopted, this congregation, adopted our own statement of conscience on racial justice last May, which says that we stand in support of and in solidarity with communities of color in our county in their efforts to decrease violence in their communities and to promote improved health, economic, and well-being outcomes in their communities. Our Peace, Justice, and Sustainability group made it possible to buy this banner. And several of our members got to bring it to Ferguson last month to be part of marking the one-year anniversary of Mike Brown's shooting and death. They and I would like to hang it on the brick wall of our building out there. And we've actually gone so far as to put wooden strips up there to hang the banner. The plan was to bless this banner at today's service and to ceremoniously bring it outside, all of us together. It felt really good to hang up the sign that we had in the window last winter. And I'm pretty sure there are people here, people in this congregation, who are uncomfortable with it. That there are conversations we should be having about how we should be standing in support and solidarity. And I know that the banner that First Unitarian Society put up last week was torn down. And I know that some of their members have had their yard signs vandalized. And so before we hang this banner that is big and bright and proclaims who we are and vulnerable to being damaged and a vehicle for us to have very difficult conversations, I want to do that. I want to have those conversations first. I'm going to post in our newsletter and our weekly emails several opportunities for us to do that. These will be our first chances to talk through our congregation's role beyond the statement of conscience in a structured way. I think that's important. I think it's more important than taking the banner and going, "Here it is," before we've had those conversations. No matter how you feel about it, I hope you will come and we can have those conversations, because we're part of a faith community that believes that every person is important. And I believe we need to learn together, to continue to learn to stand together when we have differing opinions on how to do that. May it be so. May we be so.